Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast After Dark, the after show for the Filmcast where we talk about a variety of random topics that didn't make it into the show. I'm David Chen. I'm here with Devinder Hardwar and Jeff Kanata. This episode brought to you courtesy of the fine folks at patreon.com/filmpodcast.
Thank you.
Okay.
Was that a spooky one, Jeff?
That was my spoopy one, yeah.
Spooky.
You keep saying spoopy, by the way.
Is that because I'm cool and hip like the kids on the internet, Dave. That's what all the kids on the internet say is spoopy.
Is that really true? I've literally never heard this until you said that. Yeah.
It's a big internet thing. It's a big like Twitch. Maybe it's Twitch. Your spoopy
Twitch.
Games for spoopy season.
That's cool.
That's cool.
Don't know what's going on over there.
Not something I'd heard of before. You know, speaking of spooky season, one can't help but notice the prominent reemergence of Spirit Halloween stores all around the country. I don't know if you've seen. I actually thought about watching the Spirit Halloween movie as a little bit for the podcast. I don't know if you
are interested.
No, thank you. No, thank you. So, well, maybe we can make an argument for Five Nights at Freddy's, you know, but yeah.
Yeah, I think that's probably on the calendar. But Spirit Halloween, isn't Christopher Lloyd in that movie or something like that? Anyway, okay.
Poor guy.
No, I'm. You know, sometimes I try to gauge the guy's interest in something, and I'm getting a brick wall right now.
Lloyd has never been in anything bad.
I'm getting, a side note, Jeff. I did see this wrestler's documentary that's on Netflix. Mm-hmm.
Is it good?
Oh no! Sorry. I didn't see it. I saw people talking about it, and apparently.
I didn't finish my sentence.
You interrupted me when I finished my sentence.
I interrupted you after you said the wrong sentence.
I did see this wrestler's documentary was being talked about online, was going to be the end of the sentence.
Didn't actually watch it.
Okay. Sorry. Sorry,
I
Jeff.
Read the Wikipedia entry.
Said, sorry that my sentences don't make sense when you interrupt them halfway through.
I said no. Money down.
And apparently it's incredible. This new wrestler's documentary that's coming out on Netflix. So
can I tell you something? Can I tell you a little secret, Dave?
What's up?
Literally every wrestling documentary I've ever seen, and I've seen many of them, is awesome because it is inherently dramatic, thrilling, harrowing. Like just the process of being a professional wrestler or working your way up, like it makes for great documentary. So I have no doubt that that is true.
And it's by the people who made Last Chance U and Cheer.
Cheer,
one of my favorite docuseries. So,
agreed, same here.
It's definitely on my list. Definitely on my list. Speaking of no money down, by the way, the other, literally, Filmcast continues to keep its finger on the pulse of society because the other week we were just talking about the use of the word cromulent on the podcast. No more than 2 weeks ago have we discussed it. Then Merriam-Webster adds the word cromulent to the dictionary, it's incredible.
As it should be.
Yeah.
This is correct.
I hope my understanding is they're also adding Money Horse and, they're listeners is what I'm saying over at Merriam. Merriam is, Webster is, both of them.
They will soon. Anyway, cromulent means informal and humorous. Basically, like there's terms designating what the word is, informal and humorous, and then the definition is acceptable, comma, satisfactory. So that is the definition of cromulent. Filmcast continuing to predict the things that will be important.
I mean, early Simpsons has done everything. Like clearly, the name like a more culturally influential, you know, creation.
You can't.
It's kind of wild. Like I remember when I visited South America in like 1997, remote villages that took 3 hours to drive to. Kids are wearing Bart Simpson shirts. It was just really, really wild. Yeah.
Anything that's been around for 35
years.
More to
do with supply chain stuff than
supply chain stuff too. But they also like The Simpsons. Yes, they also that's like The Simpsons. You know, and watched it. Yeah.
Yeah. Jeff, what were you gonna say?
I just said anything that's been around 35 years is going to be have an impact. You know,
it's really the
first 10 that was critical.
Although I know you like it more now, Jeff. Like
I've rediscovered my love of it, but I don't disagree. I mean, I think people of a certain age like we are, it was very formulating.
I spent 10 years of my life doing homework every afternoon while watching The Simpsons. Same, so that stuff is just like in my brain.
Yeah. I used to say, in college, I used to say my litmus test for whether I could be friends with someone is like if I could say a Simpsons quote and they got it. Mm-hmm. Like that was literally the test. So
wow.
I watched this TikTok recently that was just a guy describing Simpsons gags. But he was saying how his favorite Simpsons gags are when you think you know where the joke is going to go. Mm-hmm. And then it will like subvert it. So like a couple of examples would be like Homer's trying to get away from a guard dog and he like grabs a bunch of sausages, right? And you think he's going to throw this. He's like, this is going to help me get away. And you think he's going to throw the sausages to the dog, but he like eats them all. And he's like, those sausages will power me during my run. You know, like.
So funny.
Or like there's like there's an episode where Homer's dressed like Krusty. You know, and one of the mafia people says, like, I'm seeing double four Krusties, you know, and it's like it's just like you think, you know, what the joke is going to be or what he's going to say next, but it subverts it.
Yeah,
I feel like I've incorporated Simpsons jokes so deep into my vocabulary, like
they're just a part of us now.
We're rapidly approaching the point. I mean, we've already reached the point, actually. We're like, many people don't even understand what the fuck we're talking about when we
entire generation, Simpsons like reference. Gen Z.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, at least the early Simpsons references. I'm not sure because like these are apparently it was The Office. It's The Office references that they are growing up on, similarly to The Simpsons. So also by what a similar showrunner too, right? So yeah.
I feel like The Office Greg is Daniels, to them Greg Daniels, as maybe Seinfeld was to us, you know? I don't know about The Simpsons feels like it hovers above all of it, but I don't know. Maybe I'm...
I'd like to think so.
There are generational differences out there. I just saw somebody post a tweet saying Beyonce was the first musician to incorporate, like really highlight the visual elements of her act. And I'm like, good God, children. Has history done Michael Jackson, Prince, Madonna, David Bowie? Read a book, watch me MTV back in the day. I don't know.
Wow, Devendra, your acceleration into old man tendencies is
because we are seeing what happens. We are seeing like the lack of information and people forming entire worldviews around them. Like, oh my God, we gotta help the youth out here.
Yeah. It's you know what it is? It's the goatification of everything. You know, this is the greatest of all time. Well,
that's true.
In the last 4 years that you can recall, maybe it's the greatest. But of all time is a longer period than you know.
And culture, the long tail of culture is incredibly long. I don't know how we're going to deal with that. We're still talking about Elvis. You know, it's just wild.
I watched this video that was very moving to me recently. I posted about it on Instagram, and it was a video. It's a YouTube video. You can find it about the scale of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right?
And what this person did was they created a essentially like scale model of time. Right. And they did. It was very clever the way they did it. They did two scale models. So they go out to the middle of the desert, and they basically put these markers in place. Like, so they're driving miles.
Yeah,
they're driving like miles to like plant these markers. Okay. This is the beginning of when humans develop fire, right?
Yeah, we need some good visual YouTube content. Let's go to the desert.
Exactly. Well, he put these markers and he drives like, you know, 500 meters or whatever. Mm-hmm, and he puts another, he's like, this is when like the Bronze Age and so on and so forth. And until he like, you know, develops like a whole thing of human history that like lasts for like miles. And he uses drone footage to show like how tiny modern life has been compared to, you know, the development of the internet has been compared to like the span of human time. Then made another model in the same area that's like the full span of like the Big Bang until now.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then like, and it's basically like, okay, the previous model would be like this big. And he holds his hand like, you know, 2 feet in front of him, you know? And your life is the length of like, is the width of one human hair. Essentially, in the span of like the fullness of time, and it really just made me think what a tragedy it is that we spend so much of our time being unhappy. You know,
truly,
Wow,
can't treat each other well.
This is the thing that made you realize that. Yeah,
that's the thing.
I like the one. I don't remember who it is. It might have been Hank Green or his brother. I don't remember who pointed this out.
Yeah, the 24 hours, that one? Yeah.
No, no, the one where you know, if all of history is a book that's 1,000 pages long,
yeah,
human beings show up in the last paragraph of the last page,
right?
And you know, all of recorded human history, all of our like actual written down cultures is like the last sentence of 1,000 page.
Yeah,
book.
Yeah, yeah. They did a similar analogy of like if the time that humans have began was one day. Then, like, you know, the 20th century would be like the last like minute or something. You know, it's like something like that. So, anyway, just thinking about your life in geologic.
Just thinking about
anyway,
time
scale. We're all insignificant gnats. Good night, everybody.
All right. Here is a quick question we're going to get to, and then we're going to review The Exorcist, the 1973 William Friedkin movie. Jesper wrote into patreon.com/filmpodcast. This is a really great question. Probably Jeff won't have anything to say about this, but me and Devinder probably do.
So not a great question then, maybe?
Oh, what is it like to be smart? No, I'm just joking. when you decide, I have great respect for Jeff's intelligence. I'm just joking. When you decide to buy physical copies of movies that belong to series, do you feel like you have to get the whole set, even though you might only like a few of the movies?
Oh, no.
Do you feel differently if you like the first entries, but don't like the last few entries? For example, Star Wars 7, 8, and 9, would you be all right just buying episodes 7 and 8 and skipping 9, making the setting complete? How about if you dislike a middle entry, but you like the ones before and after? Do you skip the entry you don't like and buy the entries you do like? For example, Mission Impossible, do you buy the first movie, but skip the second and third movie to buy 4 and onwards?
How question dare you?
I buy every
single Mission Impossible.
Yeah, you buy every single Mission Impossible. I would say that in general, it sounds like Devinder and I are agreed, only buy the things that you want to buy. Like, don't buy...
Yeah, but I will say my overriding force is I'm very cheap. So if the deal is you get the 4K Blu-rays of the last few Star Wars for $20, I don't care if, you know, Jedi Rise of Skywalker is in there. Yeah,
right.
That's ultimately it. Like, yeah. I will not go out of my way to buy the movies I don't like, but I don't really care if it's in the set. Yeah,
I 100% agree. I also think if there's a situation where there's just like one movie would make the set complete.
Yeah,
you know, like Mission Impossible 2. It's pretty weak movie. Pretty weak movie.
Didn't get a great 4K remaster. Like, it's not.
But it's like, like, okay. I like all the other Mission Impossible movies I really love. So it's like, I'm probably just going to get that one to complete the set, you know? But yeah, I think...
It depends on the series, too. Like, Fast and Furious, right? I don't care if Too Fast and Too Furious is not in my collection of Fast and Furious movies.
Right.
So I've been picking and choosing those for 4K.
I mean, the thing that... When we were coming up in the movie scene, Devitra, like, the thing that was very prominent, like, was a big deal at the time was this thing called double dipping. Which, by the way, is relevant to today's conversation.
Still happening. As well. Now we're on to like quadruple.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing.
Dipping,
so the idea of double dipping is sometimes what studios would do is they would release multiple versions of the same movie at different times. So you'd have like Memento, the regular disc. Then you'd have Memento, the special edition. Right?
A year
then,
later. Yeah.
A year later. And then you need to buy both. That's called a double, like the studio is double dipping. Or you would talk about like, are you going to double dip and buy both DVDs, right?
Yeah,
like,
the original Lord of the Rings cuts or the extended
or the
cuts
extended
or the box set that has both.
Right, right. Those, like, it would be called double dipping. What we couldn't have foreseen, I mean, we could have foreseen if we could have easily foreseen, but is that we're now way beyond double. We're into like quintuple, dodecatuple dipping now, because what happens is for movies that are parts of long-running franchises, James Bond, Mission Impossible, Fast and Furious, every year there's a new box set of like all of them. Every year there's like a special edition of the new one, you know, like every year. And so it's like, it's hard to be super thrifty when you're trying to acquire physical media these days, all I'm saying, you know, like
it is, but also like it's a weird thing where I think they dug their own grave by dipping so often, so that as soon as digital came about and it was cheaper and easier and streaming came about, people were like, why am I buying things?
Yeah,
so now it's like the market's really only left
you end up
to
like
us.
Jeff Cannata, who like doesn't buy anything, you know.
Yeah.
Hey man, fool me once, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
dip me once. Won't be dipped again.
Don't buy things that you don't like. And I think I've shared this before, but I used to just buy anything that was a good deal. Oh, yeah, hey, I kind of like that movie. Let's buy. But like now, as you get older, as I get older, I'm like, I want my physical media collection to represent my interests, like to represent the things I love the most. Like you can, ideally you can look at this thing and be like, oh, that's what David Chen loved, you know, as opposed to, oh, David Chen got the Blu-ray of 777. What was that movie? 999? The 2016 film 999. Oh, David got the 2016 film 999 on Blu-ray for $6, you know, in 2019. Like that's,
and he has it because what a deal.
I don't want to do that anymore, you know.
I do that for digital. Like I do absolutely buy things. Or oh, you're $5, I will definitely want to see you at some point.
Sorcerer's on sale for $5. I was like, I have the Blu-ray, I'm gonna get the digital anyway just to have it. Physical media, it takes up space, so it's like,
it's a choice.
Anyway, good question. Thanks for writing in, Jesper, at patreon.com/filmpodcast.
Speaking of Mission Impossible 2, by the way, did you see the Silent Night teaser that is out there?
I haven't. I don't want to. I've heard the teaser.
Big Mission Impossible 2 vibes from that. I'm like, oh, we're back here again, John Woo. Actually looks like John Woo's take on Ghost Protocol or Rogue Nation or something. So I'm excited.
That's the one with no dialogue again.
Yeah, no dialogue.
No dialogue and Joel Kinnaman, right? So
I love Kinnaman. Yes.
On that note, speaking of no dialogue, we did get a bunch of people writing in at patreon.com/filmpodcast about our conversation about No One Will Save You last week. Jeff Cannata went on a rant is too not a kind word about it. Extended run monologue about
a spiel
about how like, oh, movies that take place, you know, before a certain time, before there were cell phones, like they're more pure, or they allow more interesting film scenarios. Many people in the comments pointing out that No One Will Save You takes place in present day, and that we would know this if we had seen some of the dates on some of the tombstones that were used.
I saw 2001, 2002 on some of the tombstones. I was like, are you right before? Like
It's present day. It's present day.
Well, I guess the movie is really trying to have its cake and eat it too, because it's everything in the movie is set. You know, she is living in a world that's out of time. Then she's living in a world.
You know what? That does make sense. She is living
purposefully so, though. Purposefully
she is living in a small town, and when you drive through these small towns, you are driving decades in the past. Trust me, folks. Like driving back from Savannah, I did like small town drives through Georgia. It's wild. It's totally wild. It's like technology doesn't exist here anymore. So
I mean, I think my sort of larger point is still pertinent. Like the movie is the movie required her to not be engaging with modern technology in order to work. And you know, whether it actually placed her in a different time period or just surrounded her with a different time period, it's kind of not really any different.
It was noticeable she did not live like the rest of us do. But I think for that character, it made sense. If we saw other people with cell phones, like I wouldn't be surprised, but they're not like relevant to the story. It's all about her. Yeah.
Right. Basically there's dates on the tombstones. And then in her notes, she writes about how long has elapsed since, you know, the dates in question. So like,
so I have to do math now to not be wrong about things.
Numbers. Yeah.
That's a bridge too far.
All right. Well, thanks for all the messages at patreon.com/filmpodcast. Let's get to it. Let's get to our review of The Exorcist.
Somewhere between science and superstition, there is another world. The world of darkness. Expected it. Nobody believed it, and nothing could stop it.
I love an old 70s trailer.
So good. Great voiceover.
Nobody could stop it. Nobody saw it coming.
And now you will be watching it in the movie theater with other people.
Don't
around
be too afraid.
You. It's so great. It's going to be, you should buy a ticket immediately.
I can't even hear you, Jeff. I heard a little bit of that. Okay. 1973,
it.
Folks. It was a heady time in the world of movies. Films like The Sting, Serpico were out in Enter the Dragon, American Graffiti, the cartoon Fox version of Robin Hood were out in 1973.
These
are some of the films that were out then.
What a year. Yeah. Godfather was a year before. Like, what a time.
I know. It was truly the heyday of movies. Anyway, there have been, I understand, three versions of The Exorcist, right? There's the original theatrical cut.
Mm-hmm.
There was a 25th anniversary special edition box set that was released in 1998 with the original ending as a special feature. And then the version you've never seen was released on VHS and DVD in 2000. That was then re-released.
Total Double Dip, by the way. Total Double Dip.
I mean,
two
years later.
2 years, man.
It was re-released on DVD and Blu-ray with slight alteration as the extended director's cut. So it's like freaking triple dip. The Blu-ray featured a restored version of both cuts. And then there was a 40th anniversary Blu-ray released in 2013 with both cuts, many previously released bonus features, and two featurettes about the writer. So multiple versions of the movie. Jeff and I saw the theatrical cut, which is the one available on Max, the one to watch for HBO. Devendra, did you watch?
I saw the version you've never seen. Yeah. But they recently remastered it in 4K, so I saw it on iTunes.
Nice.
Never seen it on iTunes in 4K. So
now you can never watch it again because now it's no longer the version you've never seen.
That's true.
Very nice.
It just disappears.
Yeah. I was entertained to see the this inner, like, you know, reading up on the movie before our conversation today, I was entertained to see this conversation that happened between Roger Ebert, legendary film critic, and William Friedkin. And in his review of the movie, Ebert suggested that this new version, right, the new version that came out in 2000, right? That's when the version that was never seen was released on DVD and VHS. Ebert suggested that that version you've never seen had more to do with marketing than with art. He's like, oh, they just did this as an excuse to release a new DVD. That's what Ebert suggested. So William Friedkin called him and was really mad about
it. You don't want to be cold called by William. Oh, man.
So
he
here's
was
what
Friedkin mad about this Friedkin conversation that you'd had.
Yeah, nicely done. Roger Ebert wrote, while these scenes may have been, like, he's talking about the extra. So the version you've ever seen has 10 extra minutes and a different ending, right? Like,
yep.
And he says, while these scenes may have various rationales in the minds of Friedkin and Blatty, they have one obvious rationale in the thinking at the studio. They provide an excuse for the theatrical re-release and will help sell the video even to those who already own the earlier version. End quote.
Oh.
Ebert advocating for the film fans, you know, decades ago.
Oh,
right?
Ebert, you summer flower, you delicate little, had no idea what was coming down the pike.
Oh, yeah.
He knew. He saw a lot of this. Yeah.
But he was like, how dare they double dip, you know, even
how
back
dare
then,
they double dip?
And, you know, a person after our hearts. Okay. So then William Friedkin calls Ebert, and then Ebert writes, I could hear the anger in his voice.
yes.
Friedkin
the best
says,
calls.
Friedkin says, you can say you don't like this version, that's fine. But to call it a marketing ploy is way off base. We had to take them, the studio, to the wall to release this version. The studio was never in favor of it. They wanted it to open in two theaters in New York and Los Angeles. We had to fight them to even think about it. They hate us because we forced them to do this by exercising a load of muscle. And if it turns out to be successful, it has nothing to do with them, end quote. So for those who think that it was just a craven marketing ploy to release The Exorcist again with a new ending, Friedkin himself was like, this is the thing I wanted. Now
it's debatable because there's a lot of interviews. Yeah. Where he's like, this is a favor to William Peter Blatty. Basically.
He started by saying, you cannot like the version and that's fine. I'm going to go with that.
Yeah.
but okay. We'll talk about the differences momentarily. Okay. let's start by talking about The Exorcist. This was my second time watching the movie. How many times have you guys seen it in the past?
It's also my second time.
Your second time, Divinity?
Really? I don't know, 10 times?
10 times,
that's
what,
that's
wow.
why I've seen the version you've never seen. I think it's a, this is one of the best movies ever made. So
Yeah. Well, Jeff, let's start with you. This is your second time.
Yeah.
I watched this movie decades ago. I think I was in high school when I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
Did
you watch it with your parents, or did you watch it by yourself?
I watched it with some high
school friends. I absolutely watched this with my parents, so that was fun.
I had heard rumors about how upsetting the movie was, and especially growing up in a Christian household, you know, like the ideas behind the movie are like deeply troubling.
I cannot think of a more like a movie built to break your young psyche, Dave. Like,
the
cross is desecrated in many, many ways.
Also like growing up, I actually think there's something really powerful about the way the movie handles religion.
Yeah.
That I'll talk about momentarily. And you should assume we're going to spoil everything about The Exorcist. But Jeff, let's start with you. I mean, this is your first, like when I watched it a long time ago, I remember thinking, oh, this is okay. You know, the vomiting stuff is kind of upsetting and so on. And the power of Christ compels you. I remember that going on for like forever.
Mm-hmm.
I had mixed feelings about the movie when I watched it as a kid. I'm curious what your original thoughts were and now what was it like to revisit it?
Yeah, I saw this in college and I came to it, you know, I was best friends with a film studies major. I was in theater school. We were sort of like drinking from the fire hose of all of the greats, right? That was a very fertile time for me growing as a cinephile because I was just exposing myself to all of these things. You know, I'd walk down the street and open my coat. No, I was being exposed to
wow.
phrasing. I was being exposed to a bunch of new things that existed, you know, before I was really aware of them. And now I was kind of getting to this place of like trying to appreciate the history of films and you know, that was when I was watching movies from other countries. Like I'd never done that before as a kid. Like I was in this place where I was was trying to grow my appreciation of different kinds of filmmaking. And I had, you know, the Exorcist was sort of out there as this cultural thing. And I think I came to it even at that time in college for the fireworks, right? For the your mother sucks cocks in hell of it all. You know, I knew that there was going to be this crazy over the top thing about it. And that's what I came to the movie for. And it delivers that. It is that. You see a little girl do things a little girl should not do. And it's disturbing. And there's sort of a, oh man, what are we watching thing? That is, I think very, you know, it very much delivers on what that version of me expected, right? And so that's where it sort of lived in my head up until now. I think I always understood its place in film history, or at least I did, you know, as I matured. And I never thought it to be a frivolous movie in that way or existing only for those fireworks. But I think I relegated it to a place in my head because that's how I have first approached it.
Right.
I'm so glad we've revisited it now because it was a revelation to me.
Oh, man.
Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to get a little personal here because this is the first time, obviously, I've seen it since being a father.
Same.
Specifically, specifically being a father of a child who has gone through, you know, my daughter has a very rare genetic condition and is special needs. And there, I have gone through a lot of being in the hospital with her, dealing with doctors, her first diagnosis was your child's going to die before she hits puberty. Like that was the first diagnosis that we got. It was harrowing and awful, and it was the worst thing that I could imagine. And there was a lot of, you know, like putting her, this little innocent thing through awful, you know, sterile, clinical thing, processes
mm-hmm.
that tore my heart out, you know? And watching The Exorcist, you know, for me this time, all of the stuff before we ever get to levitating and vomiting yeah. and
yes,
spinning our
yes.
head around
mm-hmm.
is the movie for me. It's now.
Terrifying.
It's yeah. so, so masterfully done. The journey of the mother from these just beautiful little moments of connection she has with this lovely girl. Like, the scene where they're in bed whispering to, she's like hovering over her daughter. They're whispering and they're talking about what they're going to do. And, you know, oh, what would you like to do on the, you know, and mm-hmm. they have this just magical mm-hmm. connection of mother and daughter that these two actors who are unrelated
yeah.
manifest in that moment. And just to be able to sort of linger and have this beautiful family represented, to draw a juxtaposition from where, you know, this sort of positive, lovely, idyllic thing transforming into this ugly, horrible, terrifying thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was so taken by that, and I didn't remember any of it. I didn't remember that she was an actor. I didn't remember that
she's very rich. Like
she's has very servants. Rich. Like, these are yeah. very important things for the yeah. story to work the way it does, where she has the ability to do everything
mm-hmm.
for her daughter, right? And those scenes of taking her to the doctors, them giving wrong diagnoses, but so confidently, dude, it wrecked me
mm-hmm.
watching it now. Wrecked me. Because I lived that, right? And you just, like, that performance of her, just, like, I know as a parent, I'm sorry. I know as a parent what I know. I'm mm-hmm. the closest thing to this, and what you're telling me doesn't make any sense.
Yep.
And to, like, abstract that into this supernatural thing, but what you're really talking about is the powerlessness at the heart of not as a parent, not having any agency, not being able to help, like understanding there's something wrong, turning to experts and saying, help me. And mm-hmm. they can't, or they won't, or they don't know how,
or they dismiss
do it wrong.
You know? Yeah.
And
yeah.
like the, as powerful and terrifying and effective as the supernatural stuff is later in the movie, it's nothing compared to like sticking to me,
mm-hmm.
watching it again. It was nothing compared to putting her in the machines and sticking her with the needles and drilling the hole in her neck. The things that we as humans do in the name of medicine and mm-hmm. and you know, not that I'm anti-medicine or science, but I don't want to be mm-hmm. interpreted that way, but like just putting this innocent thing that we just because we're struggling to understand and we don't get it, those were the scenes that felt like a revelation to me, that landed on me and in a completely new way
mm-hmm.
and really made me appreciate the filmmaking, the like the time that is taken, the pace of this movie, the like we don't get, and I didn't remember this, we don't get to head spinning mm-hmm. around for a long time. But
I don't think we get to the exorcism until at least an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's 30 minutes movie, basically.
You know,
yeah. Until the end, yeah. And I didn't remember that, right? Because it looms so largely because it is so outsized and
yeah.
and you know
it's been parodied and showed yes. on clip shows mm-hmm. and like you've yeah. seen it so many times.
Linda
and, like,
Blair yes. herself has been out there in the parody,
it's,
so
it's yeah. memorable, yeah. right? Seeing a little girl do all those things, it, of course, it's gonna overshadow all of the subtle, beautiful setup. But like rewatching the movie, I realized the movie is the lead up, right? The vast majority of the movie is the lead up. And the other thing that struck me, honestly, guys, is like the end. I don't know what the new ending was. I'll
talk about
that. There's a version I've never seen. I don't know what they call it, but I've never seen it.
It is the very happy ending. It is wild, and I'll explain it later.
Oh, I can't wait to hear. But I thought the ending of this version on Max, the one to watch for HBO, was so abrupt. It really just drops off. You're done. And just like, well, but there's so many questions. There's no moment of possession, right? There's no like, it just very gradually happens to this girl. There's no reason it's her. There's no like, in contrast to like how horror movies tend to work nowadays, there's no moment where you go, where she like grabs the thing and then it gets into her and transforms her.
How does Father Karras in Iraq at an archaeological dig relate to this girl in Washington, D.C.? That connection is never made.
Never made.
Father Marin is
Father Marin,
I loved, forgive me for not having the names in front of me. I loved the reluctant priest and his whole, like his whole thing, his relationship to his mom, his inner life, his not wanting to even do it. Like,
he's lost his faith. He's lost his faith. And now this is like the greatest test of faith.
All of that movie that happens well before the exorcism is so good. It's masterful. It truly is one of the greatest movies I've ever seen. But then sort of the ending is kind of baffling because we get the death of a character completely off screen, you know, which you feel like that's pretty climactic. You want to see that. And then we just show up and he's like, I'm not feeling so good. So, what happened? And then it's over. She's out and we're done. And it's like, the movie's over. We're done.
We're done. Yeah.
So anyway, I've talked a long time, but I have a whole new appreciation for this movie. And I'm so happy we revisited it. Mm-hmm. It's truly incredible. And I think there are huge shoes to fill now. I really pushed for us to talk about this before, because tonight I'm going to see Believer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I really wanted to get all of these feelings out before they're colored by a sequel. I've never seen any of the sequels. So this will be the first sequel to an Exorcist I've ever seen. And I think it has massive shoes to fill. So I'm very curious how it does that.
There have been four additional Exorcist films.
Yeah.
I hear the third is very good. People love the third.
Yeah. Exorcist II, The Heretic, The Exorcist III, then two prequels, Exorcist of the Beginning, Dominion, prequel to The Exorcist.
yes, Dominion.
And then there's also a TV show. That apparently
which
was
is pretty,
pretty
good.
Pretty
that
well
show
reviewed.
Was good.
Called
direct,
The Exorcist.
It was direct continuity from the movie too. Like it was a whole thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
But this is apparently Exorcist Believer is apparently part of a sequel trilogy that is planned.
It's David Gordon Green doing his Halloween thing.
Yeah, doing the Halloween thing. Which hopefully it ends a little stronger than that movie series.
Or
did.
Maybe is as interesting as that last Halloween movie. I don't know.
Exorcist Believer's out this week. Then Exorcist Deceiver is going to be out in 2025. Apparently.
Wow. Yeah.
And we'll see how that plays out. So Jeff beautifully said. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you for sharing of yourself. One thing I just wanted to point out is the horror movie scenario where the people just barely get out of the thing that they were in trouble with, and then the movie abruptly ends is like a very common like horror movie thing,
especially in
happens.
the '70s. Like there was not really room for epilogues. You kind of just done. You're out.
Well, I don't mean it necessarily even that. It's just like.
There's a lot unresolved.
We don't know. We don't really know why it worked and where the demon.
Even by that standard, this movie gives you very little information about what's going on.
We come back in the room. Dude is dead.
She's
sitting there with the most amazing look on her face.
Right.
And you go, what even happened? And then she's just sort of like better. And then we have a scene of them like, well, off to school. And I'm like,
does your version has Karras sort of like confronting her and telling the demon to come into him. And that's it. That was the solution. And he kills himself.
That doesn't really happen. I mean, I guess it does, but
no, it
does.
You see his eyes. It goes into his eyes.
He has demon face.
Yeah, he has demon face. And he kills himself. Exactly.
I think like the last willpower he'd had is to throw himself out. So
But anyway, the version you've never seen has like a more upbeat ending.
It's weird. It's so weird.
It's very weird. But my point was just that like horror movies end really abruptly, very regularly, I think. And so like I don't think this is necessarily that out of character, but I agree with you, Jeff. Mm-hmm. There's very little explained in the movie. How it
there's
happened,
a lot more mythology.
Why
we're
in northern Iraq in the first scene, you know, like all that stuff. Like none of that is explained. A lot of it is vibes. Okay, mm-hmm. Devinder Hardwar. Your thoughts on revisiting The Exorcist this time?
Yeah, so I saw this movie for the first time as a teenager with my family because we watched a lot of movies and whatever. There was not much like censorship there. But my dad definitely remembered seeing this movie in theaters as a kid in South America. And it messed him up. And he was like, oh, I don't know if you guys are ready for this. So I think it was the 98 DVD release we ended up seeing all together. And, you know, a lot of crazy things happen in that movie, but that made me a fan of this, and I've revisited it several times, but certainly not since I became a father. So, Jeff, I am right there with you, where I think this movie is an astonishing reflection of the powerlessness of being a parent. You know, it is every parent's worst nightmare, and this movie made me appreciate how great Linda Blair is as an innocent child, and not just being like an annoying child actor, but somebody who feels believable and very sweet. I'm sure this has been written about, but I really wonder like what also her experience was just making this movie, because it seems kind of rough. So it just seems like you're asking a lot of a young actor to even do this role.
Multiple people sustained pretty like what sounds like life-changing injuries as a result of being in the role.
I can imagine
both Linda Blair and Ellen Burstyn had their backs severely injured by several of the scenes that you see,
because it's just like it's a real jumping that. It's a real moving bed, it's a real like things throwing around the room after
exactly
you. But yeah, it is absolutely the powerlessness of being a parent and dealing with our medical system here in America, which is just messed up. Like this is, it's kind of worse now, like post COVID too, but also even back then, like they're not really taking the mom seriously. And I've certainly felt that before when dealing with my kids for certain things. The mom's like, the bed was moving.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, you know, this is in her head. Like this is a muscle thing or something. Right. So it's like clearly, the way doctors do not directly communicate and often, I think, dismiss patients, the way our medical system is built in a way to just like diagnose things within understandings you have, right? And throw all the tests at it. You kind of have to do that. That's understandable. But there is something like weirdly cold about it. The whole thing, like before she gets was it an MRI or an X-ray of her brain, like that whole setup of just strapping her down. And
also the fact that she gets the thing, they don't see the result they want. Yes. And they're like, well, I guess we'll just have to do it again.
Do it again.
Because I can't be wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it's like
that whole scene is like you're just watching in real time of them prepping her for this scan, which involves basically, I guess, injecting the thing that's going to be read by the machine, but also blood squirting out from her. Just harrowing. So I think this movie gets that all really right. And yeah, it's actually really important that the mom is like rich. Like she is rich. She has all the resources in front of her, but when confronted with complete evil, like what do you do? There are many situations where it feels like the systems we have in place just completely fail us. And I think this movie gets that very well. Also, this is very much a William Friedkin movie too, in terms of like just having an opening that feels completely baffling at first, right? I love that moment. I love the whole opening in Iraq with Father Marin. And basically it seems like him discovering pure evil. Like, and it's weird. Like it's just all shown. It's like, he sees this thing and it really affects him. And he goes and finds the statue and of Pazuzu, and he sees dogs fighting. He sees a guy staring at him. That's all it is. It's just vibes, but he is deeply disturbed by it. Weirdly, the version you've never seen does not immediately start in Iraq. It starts in, it's just a shot of the house. It's a shot of the house and the street in Washington, D.C. Doesn't make any sense. There's no reason to put that in there other than the fact that you've seen The Exorcist before. So it's like reminding you, hey, remember this house? Remember this street? Like a lot of stuff happened here. There are changes in the version you've never seen that I think don't work. He has like subliminal flashes to Pazuzu, to the demon, like interspersed through some scenes. The spider walk scene is there.
There is a scene where the Linda Blair character spider walks downstairs, right? And so that's like a big scene that was left out of the original cut.
Yeah. And it's, I think they used CG at the time to kind of make it work too. Like it wasn't a complete effect. I think the spider walk actually looks cool and kind of comes out of nowhere and is kind of scary, but it also ends with her having like a blood coming out of her mouth upside down. It's just like too much.
You're saying they used CG when they re-released it.
Yes. When they re-released it to complete that scene.
Yeah. To complete it. Right. Yeah.
It wasn't kind of a fully finished effect.
It was very, Star Wars special editions type move, basically. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was a little too much. And I think there is some beauty to the original cut of this movie, which is just like very sparse, really cryptic, like does not give you all the information. I think there's something to it. So having watched the version you've never seen, I think I do ultimately prefer the theatrical cut. Although there are some things, there are some scenes of Reagan in the doctor's office just being kind of like messed up, like being very like confrontational with the staff, and that wasn't in the theatrical cut, so that's kind of interesting. I forget if the doctor mentions that, hey, she was like swearing up a storm after a certain point, you know. I don't know if that was in the theatrical cut, but that was kind of interesting because it kind of shows the gradual lead up to this thing taking full possession of her. I also think for Father Karras, his whole story too, it is kind of baffling. Why are we spending so much time with this priest, with his mom, you know, with this whole plot line that really does not relate to the exorcism, but it does relate to his loss of faith. And also to the way, again, to the way our systems are built to take care of people, right? Unless you are very rich, you cannot send your elderly parent to a very nice place, right? The cheapest places they go to, that retirement home was like hell. What the people are going through. I don't know if you guys have ever experienced this, but I used to visit my grandmother in a retirement home. It was not this bad because this was awful, but there was a certain sadness there. There's a certain like, oh man, these are the people who raised these families. These are the people who took care of everyone. And they are just kind of just wasting their time in a room where nobody really cares about them. And it always made me really sad. So just having that in there too, like, this entire movie feels like an indictment against our medical system in so many ways and the way we care for each other. So I found that really compelling too. I could talk like, oh yeah, the scary horror stuff. Like it's all very good. And I think very good for the time and very shocking too. Like I love how this is very much a 70s horror movie, right? But done in the style of like gritty 70s crime dramas, you know, like it is fairly grounded until it's not. And then when it goes supernatural and goes extreme, it goes all the way there, you know. And I think like the shockingness of this movie I think is also really brave, and it may seem like just shock value now, but I think like even thinking back then to what happens with the crucifix in this movie and what the girl says, like what the demon says, I think it's, you come out of this movie kind of just shell-shocked in terms of everything you've just seen. I will say the version you've never seen has a not so great ending because it does give you more after they drive off. The medallion or the necklace, the priest gives it back to Ellen Burstyn's character. So it's sort of like she's accepting a little bit of faith in her life, whereas she was somebody who was like trying to be, or such, like she was, right, you know, she was not very religious before.
Yeah, mm-hmm. In the original cut, yes, Ellen Burstyn's character hands Father Dyer Karras's medallion, right?
Yep.
And is like, and he Dyer takes it. Accepts it. In the director's cut, instead of Chris handling Karras' medallion to Dyer, essentially rejecting faith, the alternate cut shows audiences that Chris kept the medallion, and by extension,
no, she gives it to Dyer, and Dyer like looks at it and holds it and gives it back to her.
Yeah, that's, so what, I Chris, that's what I'm saying. Chris keeps it. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so, she keeps it, but because he gives it.
Yeah,
to
but
her,
he gives because, it because he gives it back. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But the also, biggest, thing, right, is the very last shot of The Exorcist original cut. Mm-hmm. Is Father Dyer kind of standing at the top of those stairs, which were made super famous by the Apple TV Plus movie Ghosted.
Oh my God, is that where they
are? I'm just showing you. Yeah. There's a big scene.
Yeah.
For those who've seen Ghosted, there's a big scene where they like run up those stairs.
Is it the same stairs?
It's the same stairs. It's the exact same stairs.
Sacrilegious.
When you go to the stairs, Jeff, you would hate this. When you go to the stairs, there's a plaque on those stairs, and it says, You know, these several stairs,
people died here.
These stairs appeared in The Exorcist, and at the very end of the movie, Father Karras plunges to his death on these stairs. And it's like, why are you spoiling the movie for like for random generation. People looking at this plaque, guys? So anyway, it's the same stairs as in Ghosted. At the end of The Exorcist, the original cut, you see Father Dyer.
There's plaques all around that city just spoiling movies. I mean, there's just a plaque that says Bruce Willis was dead the whole time. It's like, what does that even have to do with anything?
There's a plaque on the White House. It's like, this is where at the end of White House Down.
No, this building was blown up in the Independence.
Yeah, and then
spoiler
plaques.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Spoiler
plaques. So at the end,
love that. Like if we lived in a real metaverse and you just walked by a thing like spoiler, the scene was actually shot here, because that would actually be all over Georgia. That would be fascinating. Yeah.
Okay. Now I need to find. Here's what it actually says on the plaque. I'll read it. These iconic steps were featured in William Friedkin's 1973 Warner Brothers classic motion picture, based on the novel and screenplay by William Peter Blatty, The Exorcist.
And the Apple TV Plus masterpiece, Ghosted. Yes.
Yes. In the film's climactic ending, Father Karras, actor Jason Miller, plummets the 75 steps to his death.
You didn't need that there.
You could have just, brevity is the soul of wit, guys. Just leave it.
Yeah.
Just leave it.
We understand why, you know, if you've seen the movie, you don't need the explanation. And if you haven't seen the movie, you get enough from saying these are in the movie. Like, you don't need to, there's no.
You should go see it.
What's also amazing too is the stairs appear multiple times in the movie. If it was just for that one scene, then I'd understand. People might be like, wait, I don't remember seeing that. But it's like, the stairs are a major plot point in the film.
Those are freaky looking stairs. Like, if I live there, I'd be like, I gotta go down those stairs again.
Yeah.
Like, I think the cop who's going up at by the end is like, oh my God, I could, that's like 50 stairs.
It would be unnerving to live there, because it's like on these stairs, two separate characters died in the Exorcist movie. Okay.
And also Demon hung out really close.
Demon hung out.
Okay, so
I forgot to mention the cop dude who is awesome. Sorry.
I love the cop dude.
He was amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
My wife has this conspiracy theory that like he's not actually a cop.
he's just some guy because there's no
real evidence. You never see him like at a police station, you know, so like he could just be some guy. Anyway,
Lee J. Cobb is who plays Lieutenant Kinnerman, and he is
film
awesome.
Podcaster, like if he was a real person, he'd be the cop with the film podcast. He loves to analyze, he loves to criticize,
well,
you know, critical analysis,
please. True crime
film podcast. Ooh.
So at the end of The Exorcist, you see Father Dyer standing at the top of the stairs.
Yep.
And he like looks at the stairs and like contemplates life a little bit, and then he walks away, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the end of the movie, as far as I recall. In the new version,
I can explain it.
Let me read here from a Screen Rant description of it, okay? Detective William Kinderman, the guy you just mentioned, Jeff, shows up after Chris and Regan leave Father Dyer. The two of them discuss their affection for films, and the film ends cautiously optimistic. The friendship that Dyer and Kinderman kindle is further explored in The Exorcist 3, which takes place 15 years after the events of The Exorcist.
Yes. I could have said that a lot more funny, Dave, but okay.
He did say Kinderman kindles, so that was pretty
Kinderman
funny.
Kinderman kindles. Yeah. But the detective comes back and he's like, hey, buddy, you want to go see a movie? He's like, just go want to hang out. And it's just they're arm in arm. They are walking. And then he's like, oh, yeah, I don't want to. The priest kind of does the joke that Karras did before. Like, I've seen that movie. He's like, and the cop's like, well, have you eaten lunch yet? I have not. Let's go, buddy. Arm in arm down the street. And you'd expect like a jaunty tune, like the Odd Couple theme to start playing at the end. And then it's like cut to credits. The Exorcist. It's so weird.
That's weird, right? Jeff, isn't that weird? That's weird.
It's super so weird. And that's apparently weird. Friedkin said Friedkin, I think his quote was, I shot that ending. It was garbage. But he basically put it back in because the whole version you've never seen was kind of a favor to William Peter Blatty. They had a falling out, and I think they reconciled over the years, because it was like 20 years since the movie came out, right? 30 years, pretty much. So a lot of the changes were related to what Blatty wanted. Blatty wanted a more hopeful ending to say that, you know, evil didn't triumph. I think we kind of get that. I think we get that the evil was vanquished. But also there are other, there are scenes with Karis and both priests basically and talking Marin, to each other, and Marin, both talking to each other. Whereas in the theatrical cut, when they take a break, when they take five amid the exorcist, they kind of just sit there in silence outside the bedroom. But they have like a conversation about faith. So I think it is a little deeper. And there are some elements of the version you've never seen that I like. I just hate this ending. Like, you don't need it.
All right, let's just be, you know, I think you're probably right in many regards, Devendra, but let's get from the horse's mouth here, okay?
Go.
Friedkin says that when the original movie came out, Blatty, who is the writer of the Exorcist, when the picture came out, Blatty was vitriolic. He was harsh. He would denounce the picture. Then over the years, our relationship mellowed into friendly banter, end quote. Which is very, very similar to the arc of the film cast, by the way.
Except in reverse.
They probably went to go...
started with friendly banter. Now it's vitriol.
Yeah.
But that's where the cop character came in. They probably went to go see a lot of movies together and just had a lot of conversations after. I don't know.
So yeah. Roger Ebert says he doesn't like the ending. He says it's like a guest who keeps talking after the party's over.
Yeah.
And
the party in this case is a little girl shoving a crucifix in her crotch.
Friedkin says, I originally thought we should just cut it off as he did. Blatty always thought we should show normal life resuming. Now I prefer this ending, says William Friedkin. This was, by the way, this interview was given in 2000.
Yes.
Now I prefer this ending. I love seeing Lee J. Cobb. It reminds me how great he was to work with, end quote.
Oh, that guy is amazing, dude.
He's such a weird character, like, out of nowhere. Like, in this movie filled with dread and a little girl and parents being, you know, just terrified for their children, you have this cop who loves movies. And he, like, he just, like, has a really, really weird interrogation style. And it really comes out of nowhere. Good. It's amazing.
He was in 12 Angry Men.
Yeah, yeah.
And On the Waterfront. Like, this dude's a dude.
So anyway, Devendra, you know, the way you described it was like, you know, he did it just because Blatty wanted to do it. And it's like, okay,
that's
partially true, but also
both are true.
But
both
also William Friedkin came to peace with the new ending, or whatever.
What I said before was true. Like, he did say he didn't like that ending. That's partially why it was not in the original theatrical cut.
It's true. And also,
like,
I think
to be absolutely clear, the theatrical cut is the director's cut. The version you've never seen is Blatty's cut, basically.
Well,
like, yeah,
that's what I'm saying. Is based off of this interview,
he came to accept it. That doesn't mean he. That's yeah. I've come to accept our relationship, Dave. That doesn't mean I initially liked it at the beginning. Okay,
that is also. But it also means that they're both director's cuts. How about that? They're both director's cuts. We can agree.
They both involve the director. Yes. Yeah. But if William Peter Blatty wasn't here being like, we got all these scenes. We could do more with it.
The reason I'm pushing back on this point, Devendra, is because at the very end of this interview, William Friedkin says the following. He says, have you ever heard of the story of how the French painter Bernard, when he was an old man, went into the Louvre with a paintbrush and started touching up his paintings? Mm-hmm. They threw him out. But they're my paintings, he said. He saw them differently now. I feel the same way. Given the chance, I'd go back and redo everything I've done.
We got to stop this. This is a pox upon
Friedkin
our culture.
So himself is like, I'd go back and redo everything if I had the chance. So
yeah.
Guys, I'm sorry. I haven't been participating or listening to anything you've been saying.
Yeah. It's okay.
I have been spiraling because I realize why I know Lee J. Cobb.
Uh-huh.
He was the original Willie Loman.
Mm.
He originated the role of Willie Loman on stage, and there's a film version that I saw. He doesn't have the mustache, so that's why I didn't get it. He was the original Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman, and what a powerhouse actor!
What a great parent presence.
That is very cool, Jeff. And also, you missed a great conversation.
Not related to this movie at all.
Authorial intent.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry that you weren't here for that. Anyway,
thanks for your contribution, Jeffrey.
Yeah, thanks.
You're welcome, guys.
So, okay. Well, we've gone on quite a bit about this movie, and you guys have said some really lovely things about it. And
What do you think more, Dave? Because we were talking more.
Yeah, when I saw this movie, I was like, oh, that's okay. You know, that's cool. Like, it has some cool moments in it, but like, whatever. It's not. Yeah. Now I agree that it is one of the greatest movies ever made. Here's what, and I saw source. I've been watching a lot of Friedkin's movies.
You've been in the Friedkin.
I've been in the Friedkin verse real Friedkin, heavily. Friedkin. I'm looking forward to his final movies, which are going to be released on Showtime in the near future. Mm-hmm.
That is a dark sentence.
Yeah, I know. Yes.
Wow.
I was going to comment on that too. It's like, absolutely. Oh man.
That's not where you want your.
What an epitaph for a great artist.
Absolutely.
See his final movie.
Yeah,
on Showtime.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Where masters go to die.
The guy made some of the greatest movies, greatest movies of all time. All right. What stuck out to me about this movie this time around? First of all, I agree with everything you guys said about the medical scenes. Like, what struck me was how methodical it was. Mm-hmm. It was like, she has what seems to be limitless resources, right? So she's like, we're going to do this first, and then we're going to do this, and then we're going to do this. And like every single step becomes more extreme and more desperate, right?
Yeah.
Because it's like, you're not finding any of the answers, so you're trying to figure things out.
At one point, she's sitting in a room of like 10 doctors.
Yeah, of 10
doctors. You know how hard it is to get one doctor? doctor my to see your scene, kid.
My favorite part was when the doctor walks out and he's like, let me tell you, cigarette. Yes. Like, we are in a different time.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's bringing the full might of like all of her financial resources to this issue. And I had forgotten like how much of that happens, you know, in the movie and how methodical it is. Another thing I really appreciate about the movie is like watching this movie, watching many of William Friedkin's movies, Sorcerer,
To Live and Die
Hunted,
in LA.
I watched Hunted recently, To Live and Die in LA.
Yeah.
But it's like what Friedkin likes to do, I think, is he will like show you this whole character's like life and then show you this other whole character's life.
Yeah.
And then it won't explain like why these people they will are converge. Related at all. Yeah. Like, but at some point their lives intersect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like wonderful because it like leaves this question open to the audience. Like, how are these people going to end up meeting?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the points that I think is in these movies, one of the points that I come away from watching like Sorcerer, watching Exorcist is sometimes the people that are most important in your life are people that you only know for a really short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Like the people who are like the most impactful are just like just complete happenstance that you encounter these people. It's not like a long running relationship that has been nurtured over decades. It's like, oh, like boom, like our lives were on a collision course. They intersected and now we're in this thing together. And I think that idea is brought to life very forcefully in the movie. The other thing is, you know, you guys have already covered the parenting angle really, really well. The religious angle, I just want to mention.
Mm-hmm.
There is something. Here's my personal reaction. I don't put aside what the movie's trying to say. My personal reaction is there would be something oddly comforting about encountering an actual demon possession in real life.
So you know it's real. You know
right,
it's real.
Because then you'd know. You know it's real. Like, and that's
my faith is true.
That's the thing. This is what happened. This is Karras's journey.
Yeah.
In the movie is he's like at the beginning of the movie, he's like, I've lost my faith. I don't believe in this anymore. Like I've seen too much. And you see, there's so many scenes when he's like watching her levitate and all this stuff. He's like, oh my, like in his mind, he's thinking, oh my God, it's real.
Literally. Oh my God. Literally.
Oh my God. Yeah. It is real. It's all the stuff I spent my whole life investing in. It's real. And that is amazing. That's amazing, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, yes, it happens in the most horrifying form possible, and he ends up dying because of it.
Yeah. But at least he finds his,
but he
like,
finds
yeah.
his faith.
He finds his
faith. He finds his faith. Yeah. And that's something that I think is really powerful about the movie, is that like sometimes the thing that helps to restore someone's faith is not like a miracle or loaves and fishes. It's like this horrible thing. And I like how like methodical this idea was of like we need to prove that she's possessed by a demon. How? For instance, she needs to like speak in a language that she's never spoken in before, which like that's interesting. Like they had some the Catholics had some kind of scientific
they have
rigor.
A rule book
in the thing.
I mean, there was some science involved in that church for a while.
Well, there
was a
really odd moment. I don't know if I can recall the specifics of it, but there's an odd moment where he tests something and she fails the test.
Yes.
The holy water.
Oh, that's right. It was fake holy water, but she freaks out anyway.
But I wonder, the argument could be anything a priest touch is inherently holy.
I just thought that was a really interesting, unexplained Like, why?
Yeah.
You know, it throws him off a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, what is happening? We don't really even know what's really happening there.
We don't know. There is no solution from that. But yeah. I will tell you, I think the final confrontation, that is why it's so powerful to me, because it is this guy who's like, I don't know if I believe in any of this. And he sees this elderly priest coming in, just like knocks it out. It's like, I know what to say. Follow me. You reply to what I'm saying. I got the code. I got it all down. And he's like, okay, I'm just gonna be support for this guy. Walks in the room. Guy is dead. Guy is dead. Okay. He looks over. He's like, oh shit.
Bad.
It's up to me now.
It's wild that happens off screen.
It's wild that happens off screen.
You don't see what happened.
Yeah, just, that's what I said. It's such a strange moment.
The director guy dies off screen too. Like, the things just happen. The mother dies off screen. Karis's mom's just like, oh, in passing. It's like, oh, did you hear his mother died? Even though we saw her just a couple scenes ago.
Yeah.
But it's that scene of like, oh, well, I guess it's up to me. And like, he doesn't. And like, that is the pure realization of his faith, right? Of being like, okay, just give it to me.
Yeah.
Bring your evil to me and I will deal with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's really powerful. Agreed.
Amazing sequence of events, amazing moment. I do just want to bring up one last thing, which is that my wife watched this movie and she was really taken by some of the gender politics of the film, the undertones of the film, which is basically that, like, if you read the movie metaphorically, it's like this: the idea is that there's something wrong with a single mom raising a daughter.
Yes, yeah.
And what she really needs is a father to come in and like solve the problem.
I'm seeing this college essay right in front of me.
Exactly. You know, take for that what you will, but I think it's worth noting that that is the undertone of the movie.
And partially what triggers this whole thing for Reagan is overhearing the conversation with her mom and like how her dad is just unavailable.
Right.
Not there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then as a result, not as a result, but
we don't know.
Maybe, but like something terrible happens to Reagan as a result. And so anyway.
I don't think that's a bad reading at all. Yeah. And it is interesting how Ellen Burstyn's character basically exits the movie completely for the last half hour. Yeah. Like she's not present.
I would like keep an eye on what's happening there. What are you guys doing in there? My demon-possessed daughter?
But I will say that in contrast to that, I mean, I think it's impossible to look at the beginning of the movie and not see the fact that every man fails her completely. And she's the only one that sees what's actually happening with her child. Like her maternal instincts are always right. And all the men around her are always wrong until she is the one that goes and pleads with the man who also does not believe her. Like she's the only one who's right. So in that sense, like, I don't necessarily know that it's as sort of anti single mom as maybe I think it's part,
not necessarily anti-single mom, but part of the texture of what this is, because this is a story about a single mom who has done everything, is clearly a famous movie star, has a ton of money, right? But even that's not enough.
Yeah.
But every man fails her, right? Her ex-husband fails her. The doctors fail her. The director fails her. All, you know, her like helping dude who's just like, there's no rats up here. Everybody's failing her, right? She is the only one that sees the truth of what's happening, and she is the one that has to go and plead with the man to come and do something. So I don't know. I think it's very empowering to Burstyn's character until the end where she just kind of exits the movie, which is unfortunate.
Right. Well, anyway, I think we all came away from this viewing with a renewed appreciation for this film.
This is probably bad news for Exorcist, the new Exorcist movie.
There's like, no way, right?
There's no way you can live up to this.
There's no way. I predict that I'm going to be very disappointed by this movie tonight. I also, it'll be interesting to see what this movie's like, because no one makes movies like this anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think it's unfortunate if, as I sort of predict, hope I'm wrong, but I sort of predict that this movie is going to be very modern and it'll just lean into the fireworks and not really care about any of the other stuff that I think makes The Exorcist so special.
But it's coming from David Gordon Green, who I think has made unconventional choices in those Halloween movies. I cannot predict what this man will do after those turning Halloween Michael Myers into like a patron saint of murderers or something, right? Like, I don't know. He's kind of wild. Yeah,
those movies are interesting, but I mean, they don't hold a candle to what's going on in, you know, obviously this is one of the greatest movies of all time, but it's like, what's the sort of texture and nuance of these human beings, I think is just something that's very rare to see on the big screen anymore. We get a lot of prestige television that gets closer now, but movies just don't paint characters with the same palette that they did in those days. And it's a shame.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're literally in a situation where in this movie, he spends, you know, I'm going to say 70 minutes going into these characters' backstories, not even explaining why they're related or connected to each other or how they connect to the exorcist that is the main plot or the exorcism that is the main plot, to a situation where I think it was, what's his name? Dexter Fletcher, right? The guy who directed Ghosted, recently went on, did an interview where he said that he wanted to do a moody, like, drone shot at the beginning of Ghosted to show these characters in an environment. And they said, you can't if you do that on Apple TV, they're going to click away.
That's the problem.
Algorithm says no.
We don't trust the audience anymore in the way that Friedkin trusts the audience here. We don't give the audience credit to be patient, to not have to have, like, I guarantee you there's going to be vomiting and head spinning around in the first 10 minutes of this new one, because
I don't know about that, but it's not just
not having faith though, right? It is having too much information. And when you're making movies for a streamer, they can be like, our data indicates that this there is pull off. If you don't, you
gotta show Chris Evans' face in the first 30 seconds or else it's over. But I actually think it's the opposite, Jeff.
Yeah.
I think that we are, I think the lack of faith in audiences is accurate, if that makes sense. Like, but I think William Friedkin is a director. People like William Friedkin and people like Martin Scorsese, they're people who they're like, hey, you need to trust me. I'm going to drive this ship. You need to trust me. You're going to go in places you don't understand and you don't understand where they're, you're going to just need to trust that we're going to get to a good place.
And audiences back then were more used to that.
Yeah, they could, you know, because you were there to sit in a fucking physical theater for 2 hours.
This movie is 50 years old, you know, so it's like, it's a very different style of storytelling. Every time we go back and revisit 70s movies, I'm like, man, I kind of miss this, just having this texture, having this is when we were talking about the creator. I feel like that's one of those things. This is kind of that idea, that texture of the world. Who are these characters? What do they really mean to each other? Is kind of lost in a lot of modern movies. And that's not essentially a movie that was dictated by the studios. That was a guy with his own independent vision, but still, you know, he was focusing on other things, not necessarily the richness of the world. Yeah.
Jeff, I'll give you the last word on this. I think you're saying
I see what you're saying, and I don't think you're necessarily wrong in saying it's, you know, the audience is culpable for being impatient and ADD and all the things. But like, you can't pull out of that unless there's material that asks it of you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so you know, it's a circle. It's a link.
It's totally
in a chain.
Chicken and the egg. I mean, sometimes we get great dramatic, like, slow burn movies like The Green Knight, right? And people are just there, all right there to appreciate it, right?
How dare you? How dare you hoist me on my own petard?
All right.
I had to do it.
Looking forward to discussing Exorcist Believer with you guys. This has been a great chat. And thank you as a patron for supporting the work that we do here on the Filmcast. Really appreciate it. All right. Until next week. Goodbye.